titled La Dernière Tour, Das Artensterben und die moderne Kultur, from Surkamp. An English version is to follow, entitled After Nature, Species Extinction and Modern Culture. In her current research, The Avant-Garde and the Forms of Nature, which is currently in progress, she is examining the role of biological form in works of the European, Latin American, and North American avant-garde in the 20th century. She was also a co-editor of this most useful and beloved book of all, one that is close to the heart of many Complet professors, the Longman Anthology of World Literature. She will give a talk today entitled Terminal Species, Narrative, Database, and Biodiversity Loss. Please join me in giving a warm welcome to Professor Heise.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thank you for allowing me to be here this week. It's been really fun to do the seminar as well as this conference. So I'll start where Tim left off with a sense of endings. Let me just see if I can get the connection back here. Here we are. Should not touch this. In the sense that one of the most often repeated commonplaces in theories of contemporary society is that nature has disappeared. And you probably know some of these theories. It appears in environmental historian Carolyn Merchant's idea of the death of nature, in Bill McKibben's lament about the end of nature, but also beyond environmentalism proper in theories of modernity, such as Bruno Latour's, and theories of the postmodern, such as those of Jean-François Lyotard, Jean Baudrillard, or Frederick Jameson, and in Ulrich Beck's concept of the risk society. The recurring assumption is that nature, in the sense of a realm outside human society, no longer exists. Climate change, which affects even parts of the planet where no human has ever yet set foot, is the most obvious manifestation of this fundamental change in humans' relations to nature. Now, the Nobel Prize laureate chemist Paul Crutzen, and something that Rob already alluded to this morning, has labeled the contemporary era the Anthropocene to refer to a time period in which humans are no longer the biological agents that they've always been, but have in fact become geological agents, transforming the most basic structures of the planet. Beside climate change, as Carolyn has mentioned, the current mass extinction of species, which I work on, is one of the most salient hallmarks of the Anthropocene, and that's what I'd like to focus on today. Now, as a scholar of culture, I come to biodiversity with a dual interest in the science, but also in what is scientifically known gets translated and filtered into culture, and how it becomes meaningful culturally and part of legislation and politics. So what I'll do is I'll start with a brief account of what is known about biodiversity and biodiversity loss as scientific concepts, and some of the problems with these concepts. And then there are two different modes in which species extinction is culturally represented. On one hand, through accounts of individual species extinctions that are narrated with the genre templates of elegy and tragedy, and which become tied to the stories particular cultures tell about their own history of modernization. And on the other hand, through databases of endangered and extinct species that don't focus on single species, but try to portray the general biodiversity panorama in what may well be an epic fashion. I'll only talk very briefly today about species elegy. I have an article on this subject forthcoming, and we'll focus more on the database mode. And I'll explore global biodiversity databases and red lists of endangered species as forms of cultural expression. And that's sort of part two, as you see on the slide. And we'll then try to show a few examples of how this database mode has recently become part of properly aesthetic forms and genres, and that'll sort of be part three. But now, the neatness with which I've divided my talk into three parts should not give the false impression that the scientific and cultural dimensions of species extinction are actually clearly distinct. They're not, and actually one of the most surprising discoveries for me in the research for this paper was the amount of uncertainties and open questions surrounding the science, and the way in which the stories scientists themselves tell about biodiversity, including the concept of biodiversity itself, are bound up with all kinds of cultural assumptions. And I actually, I'm just going to get my cup of water, which is left over here. So to start with just a basic background, extinction is of course a normal evolutionary process that's taken place for millions of years as a counterpart to speciation, and usually occurs at the so-called background level, which is approximately one species going extinct every 4 years. But currently, biologists estimate that we may be losing species at about 50 to 500 times the background rate. And if you add species whose fate we don't really know with certainty, the extinction rate rises to 100 to 1,000 times the background level, due mainly to habitat destruction, invasive species, pollution, human population growth, and overharvesting, what biologists conveniently abbreviate with HIPPO. While most extinctions over the last 500 years have taken place on islands, they're now spreading to continents in a sign of deepening crisis. Now, these kinds of mass extinctions, as opposed to extinctions of individual species, are extremely rare. They've only occurred 5 times in the 3.5 billion years of life on Earth, and have, of course, never before been triggered by human agency. Usually, biodiversity took many millions of years to return to pre-cataclysmic levels after each of these events. The 6th mass extinction, which we're currently undergoing, may eliminate up to 50% of currently existing animal and plant species, according to the predictions of some biologists. What the consequences of that large scale of biological transformation might be is uncertain. They include the possible collapse of some ecosystems, the destruction of some of the basic foundations of food and energy economies, the disappearance of medical and other resources for the future, as well as, of course, the disappearance of important cultural anchoring points and assets. Now, so these are just some of the basic sort of biological and ecological facts. But that basic picture is then complicated by quite a few uncertainties and open questions. And the difficulties begin with the notion of biodiversity itself, which is really hard to define precisely. Biodiversity sort of can be seen at the level of the ecosystem of the species and subspecies variation, so that just numbers of different species in an ecosystem only give you a partial picture of what the biodiversity is. How closely related the species are and what ecological functions they fulfill also matters, and how much diversity is necessary for ecosystem functioning is totally unclear. Beyond these kinds of problems of accounting, biodiversity as a concept blends ecological facts with value judgments. As David Takacs has shown, part of its force derives from the idea that scientific research might be able to guide environmental policies and politics. Many biodiversity researchers are also impassioned conservationists, so that research and political activism are not always clearly separable. That's both a difficulty, but also, of course, the potential of the biodiversity concept. Now, the species concept itself raises a number of other problems. Species have been classified in terms of Linnaean taxonomy since the 18th century, but contemporary biology has proposed a variety of different definitions. So you have Ernst Mayr's biological species concept, which is based on mating habits, and you have phylogenetic and morphological species definitions. For bacteria, none of these work too well, so biologists there use a metabolic species concept that works better at that level. The rise of molecular genetics since the middle of the 20th century has again opened up totally new possibilities for defining species. Now, these taxonomic questions are, even though they get insanely detailed and really complicated to follow, for lay people are far from merely academic. Most laws protecting endangered species presuppose some at least approximate consensus on the species concept to define what it is that we're supposed to preserve. Is it a morphological type, a reproductive group, an evolutionary line, or a genome? So the species question also ends up being political in a fairly direct sense. Now, assuming that we could settle that question, some biologists would still argue that it's misguided to structure conservation around the species concept. What matters, according to them, is not the conservation of species, but of populations, so ecologically and geographically specific subgroups of species. If bees were to disappear everywhere except in Italy, for example, the species itself wouldn't be extinct, but the consequences for agriculture would be absolutely catastrophic. So Paul Ehrlich has said in one of his more recent books, indeed it would theoretically be possible to lose no more species diversity at all, and yet because of declines in population diversity, suffer such a steep decline in ecosystem services that humanity itself would go extinct. Good old Paul Ehrlich never misses an opportunity to be apocalyptic. But so from this perspective, The focus on the conservation of species distracts us from the real problem of their geographical and ecological distribution. Difficulties about the definition of species are compounded by the fact that we have no idea how many species currently inhabit the Earth. About 1.8 million species have been scientifically classified and named, about half of those insects. Estimates of the total number vary wildly from a low of 3 million up to a high of over 100 million, with sort of the typical estimate somewhere in between 10 and 40 million, which is still sort of orders of magnitude apart. The divergence is in part due to very different assessment methods for different geographical areas and different taxa, and I can talk more about that in the Q&A if you're interested. But so what's important for right now is humans only know a fraction of the existing species, and it's fair to assume that species are constantly going extinct that humans have not yet had a chance to encounter and name. But that limit on current knowledge also implies, paradoxically, that even though we live in an age of mass extinction, the number of species is actually steadily increasing. The number of known species, that is. Ian Wilson points out that contrary to popular belief, the discovery of new species is a common occurrence, to the point where in some taxa, like insects or flowering plants, specialists can barely keep publications current with the new discoveries. Wilson himself has discovered 341 new ant species, in addition to the 10,000 already known ones. And even in well-explored taxa such as birds, new species are constantly being added to the record. And some of the newly discovered species are, of course, so rare that they immediately get added to existing red lists. Now, you can argue, of course, that the total number of species is irrelevant for the problem of mass extinction. If so many species are threatened that entire ecosystems are at risk, then we don't really need to know what the total number is. But if the argument about the end or decline of nature here is that biodiversity is declining, that is at bottom a numerical argument that it would be useful to substantiate with numbers. Questions of scale also matter for the stories that we tell about biodiversity in other ways. Human perception and cultural understanding of species loss normally focuses on the orders of magnitude closest to us, whereas processes at other scales often don't make their way into public consciousness. Our knowledge of other species is unevenly distributed across different taxonomic levels. Let me show you a little table here. This is from the 2008 edition of the IUCN Red List, which is sort of the most comprehensive global biodiversity database. In this column, you see sort of the total number of species that we know, more or less, in each taxon. The second column gives you how many have been evaluated, and the last column, how many of those are major. Now, if you look at the top here, among the approximately 5,500 species of mammals and the almost 10,000 species of birds that we know, all of them have been assessed. You drop down to fishes. We know about 31,000 species, but only about 3,500 have been evaluated. Insects, 950,000 species, we've evaluated 1,250 of them. Arachnids, 98,000 species, we've evaluated 32. Ferns and allies, I always love that phrase, almost 13,000 species, we have evaluated 211 to even know whether they are endangered or not. And my favorite example, 30,000 mushrooms, and we've evaluated one species. So what this shows is that our knowledge of biodiversity loss rests on very incomplete data. That isn't necessarily grounds for optimism. I mean, since so many of the existing species are the ones that we have assessed are endangered, you could argue that if more of them were assessed, the picture might well turn out to be worse. But the point is that we don't know that scientifically. They've simply not been looked at scientifically in terms of how endangered they are, how many of them there are, how the populations have increased or declined. So when species extinction is presented in popular science and the media as part of an overall decline of nature or the disruption of nature by humans, these arguments frequently depend on underlying assumptions and complex concepts. Issues such as definitions of biodiversity and species, scales of perception and taxonomy that are analyzed and discussed in the scientific literature but usually get foreshortened to their simplest formulae in the public discussion. So many aspects of the narrative of biodiversity loss are not as firmly anchored anchored in the in science as they appear. Now, to say that doesn't by any means imply that the constructivist arguments that somehow the problem of biodiversity loss is just a product of biased environmental rhetoric. On the contrary, the current extinction of numerous plant and animal species is real, and it's equally incontestable, I think, that humans bear the responsibility for the majority of these extinctions. But these facts do not in and of themselves add up to the narrative of the decline of nature in the modern world. The declensionist narrative, I'd like to argue, is underdetermined by the facts. It's one possible, but not the only way of translating them into story. And the reason, I think, that this narrative template recurs so frequently, I mean almost automatically, is that it has the force of at least 200 years of environmentalist storytelling behind it. And also that species loss becomes a part of stories about the development of culture. So the stories that particular cultures tell about their own development, and particularly their own modernization, colonization included. Now, culturally, species loss has translated into a profusion of popular scientific books, travel writing, films, documentaries, photographs, paintings, novels, poems, musical compositions, and video games that address either the fate of individual species or the general panorama of decreasing biodiversity. Many of these books about the sixth mass extinction take the form of global travelogues that paint horrific pictures of human misery and poverty, of governmental mismanagement and corruption, and of unbridled population growth, colonialism, and economic expansion. So you see people who kill off endangered species to eke out a living on the economic margins. And then you see those who kill them on an industrial scale and for large-scale profit. And then there are people who never targeted the endangered species in the first place, but eliminated it as a side effect to some other cultural, economic, or political activity. And the vision that underlies many of these books and essays, only a last-ditch, really large-scale conservation effort can save future generations from having to live in an utterly impoverished and homogenized natural world, with a plant and animal abundance of the past, a mere memory that you can visit in museums. Generically speaking, many of these accounts rely in more or less obvious ways on the story of the decline of nature under the impact of modernization. They tend to focus on culturally significant species whose endangerment or extinction becomes a way of expressing unease with modernization processes, and sometimes for explicitly criticizing the changes they have brought about in humans' relations to nature, and sometimes also broader changes. Now, as you probably know, the selection of species that come to symbolize biodiversity crisis in public discussions usually follows well-established patterns. The species under threat is almost always an animal, while plants, which are equally affected, receive almost no attention. Among the animals, large mammals such as gorillas, tigers, pandas, whales, or white rhinos, and birds, particularly beautiful ones such as eagles, parrots, and woodpeckers, are the preferred objects of coverage. While reptilians, amphibians, and fish are mentioned far less frequently. Frogs sometimes get a little bit of coverage when they're handsome. Among invertebrates, only photogenic butterflies occasionally come into view. Taxa such as worms, crabs, fungi, or bacteria usually remain invisible. Conservationists sometimes refer to these species as, no doubt you know, favored by the media half humorously and half disdainfully as charismatic megafauna, or more neutrally, flagship species, the animal types whose immediate appeal to the broad public makes them good tools in campaigns to raise public awareness and funds. Many conservationists are ambivalent about these species. The focus on a single species that's selected for its obvious anthropomorphic qualities or its aesthetic appeal tends to block from view other species that may be more endangered or more crucial for ecosystem functioning. But it's true, of course, that public support for conservation efforts often can't be mobilized without these flagship species. Stories of flagship species often function synecdochically. They point to broader crises in humans' interactions with nature. The first species extinction, historically speaking, that came to be seen in connection with human agency in general and modernization and colonization in particular was that of the dodo, a large flightless pigeon that inhabited the island of Mauritius and died out in the 17th century. Closer to the present, species such as the honshu wolf in Japan, the passenger pigeon and the ivory-billed woodpecker in the United States, the thylacine in Tasmania, and conflicts over the hunting of particular kinds of whales have all become cultural focus points where critiques of modernization are articulated. And I've talked in some detail about these in the article that the students who were in the seminar this week have read, and so I will not repeat that analysis here. Instead, what I'd like to zero in on is the question of how this focus on individual culturally salient species gets connected to the larger panorama of the disappearance of many far less well-known and culturally less meaningful species, including a lot of plants. Now, you see a clear tension between these different approaches. In one of the most famous popular scientific books on the current mass extinction, David Quammen's Song of the Dodo from 1996, which the students read a couple of chapters from. Now, in the chapter from which the book's title derives, Quammen focuses on the extinction of the dodo as a historical turning point where, in the midst of colonial expansion, the exhaustibility of nature manifests itself. Dutch sailors who discovered the dodo describe it as pretty unappealing in appearance as well as in taste, but they ate it anyway. And the hunting, the introduction of non-native species, and then sort of peculiarities of the dodo's anatomy and behavior led to its extinction just a few decades after its discovery. So the last one was sighted in 1662. Quammen's account of the dodo is meant above all to show that the demise of the last individual of a species, which can occur because of quite contingent circumstances, is less significant than the factors that lead a species to become so rare that these kinds of circumstances can wipe it out. But in a telling non sequitur, he then proceeds to narrate precisely the death of the fictional last dodo. Imagine a single survivor, a lonely fugitive at large on mainland Mauritius at the end of the 17th century. Imagine this fugitive as a female. She would have been bulky and flightless and befuddled, but resourceful enough to have escaped and endured when the other birds didn't, or else she was lucky. Imagine that her last hatchling had been snarfed by a feral pig, that her last fertile egg had been eaten by a monkey, that her mate was dead, clubbed by a hungry Dutch sailor, and that she had no hope of finding another. During the past half dozen years, longer than a bird could remember, she had not even set eyes on a member of her own species. Raphus cucullatus had become rare unto death, but this one flesh and blood individual still lived. Imagine that she was 30 years old or 35, an ancient age for most sorts of birds, but not impossible for a member of such a large-bodied species. She no longer ran, she waddled. Lately she was going blind. Her digestive system was balky. In the dark of an early morning in 1667, say during a rainstorm, she took cover beneath a cold stone ledge at the base of one of the Black River cliffs. She drew her head down against her body, fluffed her feathers for warmth, squinted in patient misery. She waited. She didn't know it, nor did anyone else, but she was the only dodo on earth. When the storm passed, she never opened her eyes. This is extinction. So Quammen here does precisely what he says doesn't matter. He translates the demise of a species into a narrative by focusing on a single specimen he envisions as female, which then allows him to portray her in the well-worn elegiac cliches of the bereaved mother and wife and the frail elderly lady with health problems. At the same time, he conveys a sense of affection and bemusement for this imaginary last dodo through pathetic fallacy, by juxtaposing the grim weather and the bird's physical suffering with the situation of the species as an abstract entity. So Quammen's last dodo is both totally real and completely imaginary. Real in that the extinction of its species and its anthropogenic causes can't be wished away, and symbolic in that she's entirely made up as an icon of regret for those dimensions of nature that were destroyed by modernization. But this moment of focus on a single specimen comes up in Quammen's chapter in the midst of catalogs of extinct species that sometimes run several pages long, and I'm going to spare you the really long ones, but here's a couple. Drepanis pacifica, the Hawaii mamo, was last seen in 1899. Drepanis funaria, the black mamo, disappeared in about 1907. Cyridops anna, a finch-like little honey creeper colored in patches of red, black, and gray, has been missing about as long. The Laison honey creeper is extinct. The lesser koa finch is extinct. So are the greater koa finch and the kona grosbeak and the Hawaiian rail. The greater amakihi is extinct, as are the oahu nukupuu and the kioea and the oahu ole, and at least three out of four subspecies of akialoa. The kakawahi is most likely extinct, and the olomau has been extirpated from Maui and Lanai. And just a couple of pages later, talking about Guam rather than Hawaii, then the Guam flycatcher went extinct. Blip. The bridled white-eyed disappeared. Blip. The rufous fantail, the white-throated ground dove, the Mariana fruit dove, the Micronesian honeyeater, blip, 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 blip. Of the 11 forest-dwelling species, these six all vanished from Guam during the mid-1980s. Such enumerations are quite common, not just in Quammen's book where they abound, but in other books on extinction. And in fact, the genre of the travelogue itself is often a device for narrativizing these kinds of inventories from around the globe. through these lists, and that's my point of bringing them up here, biodiversity books gesture toward the other central genre through which modern cultures engage with species extinction, and that is the database. Now, the database imaginary takes two different forms. On one hand, there are global biodiversity databases that are today all digital, and on the other hand, red lists that are used by regions, states, and international organizations to track endangered species. I'd like to suggest here that these forms of inventories can be understood as another form of contemporary nature writing, another genre in which the cultural concern over species extinction finds expression. This may seem, I realize, a bit counterintuitive at first, but I'm sure at least some of you are aware that media theorists have in recent years argued precisely that databases are, whatever their clerical or scientific utility might be, important new forms of cultural expression. So Lev Manovich, most prominently, has argued that databases are a cultural form of their own. It's a cultural form, a new symbolic form of the computer age, a new way to structure our experience of ourselves and of the world. And he's argued that as a cultural form, the database represents the world as a list of items, and it refuses to order this list. In contrast, a narrative creates a cause and effect trajectory of seemingly unordered items or events. Now, that simple juxtaposition that a database is just enumeration and narrative is cause and effect has been vigorously contested, especially by literary scholars. Catherine Hales, in that discussion that took place in the pages of PMLA in 2007, argued that so far from excluding each other, database and narrative, in fact, condition each other, sort of taking the extreme opposite stance. It seems to me that neither of these positions is in and of itself particularly helpful. What matters is, I think, at bottom, not so much whether database and narrative oppose or complement each other in some abstract sense, but how their differences are negotiated and made meaningful in particular contexts, and that's kind of what I'm after here. So in terms of what we're talking about, one of the consequences of the extinction crisis has precisely been the attempt to create global biodiversity databases, and I've put the names of a bunch of the most important ones on the slide here, the Encyclopedia of Life, Catalog of Life, the Census of Marine Life, and so on. All of them try to inventory at least the 1.8 million species that we already know and to make knowledge about them easily accessible to researchers and to conservationists. This is by no means an easy task. I mean, it's in fact incredibly hard. For technical, historical, and political reasons, information about species, many of which were named a couple of hundred years ago and recorded in obscure journals, or identified and recorded by researchers in countries that don't freely share scientific information or don't digitize it, is often really, really hard to come by and organize. Most of these databases are in fact sort of metadatabases. They sort of collect information from other databases into sort of one encompassing whole. This is also really expensive, and not all of the projects that are on this slide have their funding insured, and so all of them are in various states of incompletion. Nevertheless, what I think is interesting about them is that their aspiration is to encompass all known life forms. You could say that this is in some ways an epic aspiration. Ancient epics from Homer's Odyssey and Virgil's Aeneid to the Finnish Kalevala or the Mayan Popol Vuh all attempted to grasp the entirety of the world as it was then known. At first sight, though, biodiversity databases seem to lack the narrative element that makes epic so compelling. Although those of you who've reread your Iliad in the last 15 minutes will also remember that there are long, long catalogs there that are frustrating for the modern reader precisely because they're not narrative to our reading habits. So, anyway, this seems to be, at first sight, a textbook case of Manovich's opposition of database and narrative. But that opposition doesn't really capture the way these databases work. Sequences of cause and effect, Pace and Manovich, are actually at the heart of these database projects. Their goal is to analyze what factors determine the survival, endangerment, or extinction of species. But these connections don't emerge from narrative sequences. They emerge instead from structures that the user selects and sorts within the framework of possibilities that that database designers have enabled. The user is confronted with elements such as taxa, geographical distributions, causes of endangerment, or temporal data that can be combined in any number of different ways. And the relation of the individual elements or groups of data then typically assumes statistical form. So to go back to the slide that I showed before, so out of the
45,000 species that they assess. End result is 21% of mammals are endangered, 12% of birds, and so on and so forth. So that's sort of the set of data that you come up with in the end, and from which you then can begin to analyze what are the most important threats of extinction and what is the overall fate of particular taxa. So what replaces narrative sequence in the contemporary database epoch is the statistical relation of data sets to the whole, from which causal connections become visible, and those are then, of course, typically narrativized in more conventional form. Now, which configurations and relations are possible depends on the database structure, and in that respect, databases are anything but neutral archiving tools. As the historian of science Jeffrey Bowker has pointed out, the architecture of databases emerges from many conceptual decisions that are sometimes scientific and often also cultural in nature. As electronic archives, databases are technological forms of cultural memory, but their architecture determines what can become part of collective memory and what needs to be excluded. This is not just a matter of what information you plug into these databases and what you leave out. It's also a matter of so-called metadata, which determine by means of what criteria the archived information can be categorized and searched. So anytime you go online and you want to buy a t-shirt, whatever you find has to have had the tag t-shirt attached to it as a metadata at some point for you to be able to find it. So these metadata also determine how data in one archive can be compared, synchronized, or merged with those in another. And that's a major challenge for these biodiversity databases now underway, since the last thing you want is, in the end, have six incompatible databases that would make the whole picture more confusing rather than easier for researchers and conservationists. Now, one basic feature of these databases is that they're structured in terms of species. So in the contemporary database epoch, you could argue species are, at some level, the central literary characters. There's qualifications to that, which I've cut, so as not to make my talk too long, but as a generalization, I think this holds. Now, that's not unproblematic in view of the divergent views on the definitions and the relevance of species to biodiversity debates that I mentioned earlier. Database designers are quite conscious of that problem. The IUCN Red List, for example, started out as an inventory of endangered species, but has in recent years included more and more so-called LC, or least concerned species, so non-endangered ones, and has become sort of the most comprehensive general biodiversity database. The IUCN is fully aware that biodiversity reaches all the way from genetics to the ecosystem, and that picking out species is therefore a somewhat arbitrary decision. But according to their reasoning, species are readily recognized and offer an opportunity to measure and communicate changes at other levels of complexity. While species-based conservation cannot and should not replace efforts to conserve genetic diversity or ecosystem functioning, it's often the most readily available surrogate for conservation of biological diversity. Now, note that this justification is pragmatic, not theoretical, and it defines species as the part that stands for the whole of biological life. The other form database approaches to biodiversity take is that of the Red List, and where biodiversity databases are mostly descriptive, Red Lists are normative. They're limited to endangered and extinct species, and national, regional, and international laws and treaties concerning species protection are usually based on these lists and come with the power to mandate certain kinds of behavior. So prohibitions on hunting or harvesting certain species, on including them in trade or commerce, or on altering their habitats in particular ways. So red lists are scientific tools, but they're also legal instruments and objects of political debate. Listing and delisting species from a red list can be a really controversial political issue. Many of you may remember the case of the snail darter, species endemic to the Tennessee Valley, that was included in the then newly established Endangered Species Act in 1973 and caused like a major series of litigations over the better part of the decade between the residents of the Tennessee Valley, the Environmental Defense Council, and the Tennessee Valley Authority. More recently, the delisting of the mink whale, which I had on an earlier slide, by the NOAA, and its subsequent hunting by the Macaw Nation in the Northwest Pacific has caused intense confrontations. So in a sense, the narrative dimension of red lists lies in the prohibitions they articulate and the violations of these prohibitions or the challenges that are issued to them. their changes over time register an additional kind of narrative of species changing, of conservation efforts succeeding or failing. There's a couple of big volumes on the Endangered Species Act, after now that it's been in effect for 4 decades, and in what ways it has succeeded or failed. There's a lot more to say here, but in the interest of time, let me move on to point out that the peculiar structure of the biodiversity database and the Red List is also increasingly becoming part of more properly aesthetic genres, such as novels, paintings, and photographs. In literature, novels such as Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, Kurt Vonnegut's Galapagos, Mayra Montero's Y tú la oscuridad, Margaret Atwood's Oryx and Craig, and Lydia Millett's How the Dead Dream all integrate catalogs or narrative serializations as ways to represent multiple extinctions. The sculptor and installation artist Maya Lin instantiates a similar cataloging impulse. Let me just switch to her website here. On her website, What is Missing? So as you can see, this is sort of the home page. It's a really complex website. And you can click on each of these individual points, and it'll pull up audio and video information about a particular endangered species, and in some cases, information on installation projects that Lynn herself has done in connection with biodiversity loss in various places, in New York Times Square, and she did an installation at the San Francisco, California Academy of Sciences in San Francisco, and so forth. So that is sort of it's the biodiversity database impulse instantiated in sort of a website. Let me go back to. There's also a lot of instances in the visual arts in which artists appropriate the database aesthetic. So the painter Isabella Kirkland has focused on species and taxonomy, and in that context, specifically on endangerment and extinction. She has a series of paintings that's called Nova, that's on species that have been newly discovered in the last 20 years, and one called Taxa. Oops. Now, that series consists of 6 paintings called Descendant, Ascendant, Trade, Collection, Back and Gone, and depicts a total of about 400 species. She says on her website, almost every plant or animal in this series is measured, photographed, and drawn, and observed firsthand, either live or from preserved materials. All are painted at life size to ensure accuracy of scale. The paintings explore how current biodiversity science can inform art making, and how art objects contribute and how art objects contribute to both political and scientific dialogues. Now, as you can see, Kirkland draws on the tradition of the still life, and all of the paintings in the Taxa series are done in that style. The Descendant painting, which is the one that you can see on this slide from 1999, shows plants and animals that are in decline in the mainland United States, Hawaii, or Central America. They're shown here on something like a staircase or a florist's display, and that impression is reinforced by the portrayal of endangered plants as cut flowers in a vase. Barely visible, even in the full-size painting, you barely see that vase. It serves, nevertheless, as a centering device for many of the other species who are shown crawling on it. There's some snails crawling across it, or the birds who are facing it. But what's most remarkable here is the way in which what looks like a fairly conventional picture of flowers in a vase challenges the logic of both the still life and that of the usual representations of extinct species. So far from domestic, these are endangered wild plants. But just how interesting these possibilities of representing endangerment and extinctions through the still life can become only becomes clear through Gone, a painting that was completed 5 years later, so in 2004. The tabletop, vase, silver tray, and glass containers all emphasize the still life conventions much more insistently here, which seems to bring the extinct species into the domestic realm as if to confirm visually the theories of the end of nature that say that there is no more nature outside the social. Within the stylistic framework, the various extinct species, and those are meticulously identified through a numbered species key on the Kirkland website, are presented in strikingly different fashion. Most of the birds, like the Carolina parakeet and the passenger pigeon, so the Carolina parakeet is up here and then the passenger pigeon is right there in the middle, are presented as living birds. They're perched on the flowers as they would on a bush or a tree out in nature. They are alive. Others are made visible through their eggs. So the great auk and the pink-headed duck are represented that way, or through their feathers. The extinct fish species, by contrast, are mostly dead and laid out on a tray as if they were about to be served for dinner, with the exception of a few smaller species that swim in the vase as if it were simultaneously an aquarium. I don't know how well you can see that, but they're actually fish swimming inside the vase, and there's some mussels at the bottom. Some species, like the thylacine on the left or the blueback on the right, are presented as a skull or a pair of horns. Some reptiles are floating in jars on the left, to the left and right of the vase, with identifying tags on their legs, while some frogs, and these are dead, and then some frogs sit alive on the table, and one lizard is perched on the vase. So there's an anti-realism here that combines in an odd way with the scientific rigor of the species identification and the painting style. Species that are too large to fit on a table tend to be represented by body parts, in keeping with realism and still life conventions. But the fact that the water container doubles as an aquarium also gives a tinge of surrealism to the whole. And the whole presents itself as a cross-geographic collage of species that would never encounter each other in a normal ecological context. So the generic generic device of the still life is here mobilized to create something quite a bit more strange, a sort of ecological collage of extinction, sort of a database. Case paintings, therefore, use the genre of the still life to connect to the memory practice of the database. The taxonomic impulse that shapes not only the title, taxa, and the species indices of the various paintings also manifests itself more subtly in the way in which Kay deploys the conventions of still life. Through the painting's surreal elements, she makes us reflect on the way in which species are culturally tagged for scientific, gastronomic, historic, collectors, or aesthetic approaches, and how that in itself makes extinction mean differently in each of these contexts. The painting combines, in other words, a reflection on the database of nature with a reflection on the database of culture and their different classifying systems of fauna and flora. Now, even closer to a pure database mode is the work of the photos journalist Joel Sartore, whose work has long linked his portrait-style photographs of a wide variety of species with conservation. And he has a lot of different series and has just published a book that came out a few months ago called Rare, America's Most Endangered Species. A lot of photos from a series called Last Ones, Threatened and Endangered Species, has appeared in feature articles in National Geographic and so on. Now, this is an example of a work where Sartori combines elements of the elegiac and of the database aesthetic. The photo foregrounds how a living organism is transformed into an archival specimen, preserved in a jar and tagged for the archives, and the bird's isolation on the white background in the jar and in fluid visually concretizes its loss of habitat. But this is all a small, pathetic, dead bird that it's difficult not to feel compassion for. And the fact that Sartori provides an explanatory caption with the bird's gender and name on his website reinforces the elegiac dimension. So this is very close, of course, to Quammen's Last Dodo. Most of Sartori's photos, though, are more starkly desentimentalized. In the majority of cases, he presents the animals in crisp, beautifully detailed portraits against a stark black or white background, not usually in any kind of habitat. On his website, the reason he gives for this choice is that he wants to treat species equally, regardless of their use, their aesthetic or emotional appeal to humans, and he explicitly links that to the way in which they're treated by the Endangered Species Act. Since its inception in 1973, the ESA has become the most important tool in the fight to save animals from extinction. Though much maligned and woefully underfunded, the law protects all creatures great and small, from ocelots to beach mice. It even protects a single species of fly found on the California coast. By isolating species on black and white backgrounds, all are given equal consideration and hopefully equal attention by readers. Public support of the law is vital to its continuance, saving hundreds of species for future generations. Now, Sartori's zoological interests reach across taxa and include a lot of invertebrates, sometimes also shot in a for them unusual portrait style. Now, as you can see, this technique often delivers striking results. The equal treatment of vastly different species makes one lose a sense of their size and proportion, and the empty backgrounds give no sense of habitat or ecosystem connectedness. On the contrary, they isolate the subject to the point where it appears artifactual and decorative rather than biologically embedded. Among the examples here, that's of course particularly true of the fish, which appears strangely lifeless and mounted with no water anywhere in sight, but in a movement that clearly derives from a watery background. So this clinical and classificatory approach may seem at odds with environmentalist perspectives that usually farm around connectedness and rootedness. But that, it seems to me, is precisely the point. This is at some level an attempt to de-romanticize species and their disappearance by making the conservationist appeal at a purely aesthetic level. Sartori's photography is very good at highlighting the beauty and strangeness of individual organisms, to the point where even ordinary life forms come to resemble aliens in outer space. The juxtaposition of many such photographs, as in another of his series, Biodiversity Collection, successfully conveys a sense of the rich variety of life on the planet. So the cultural modes of engaging with biodiversity loss that I've discussed here negotiate the interface between species loss statistics and individual species. But they do that in quite different ways. Elegy focuses on a single species and makes it the synecdoche for what might be wrong with a particular history of modernization, and thereby makes it part of a particular kind of cultural politics. Databases, I'd suggest, have the potential for opening up a different perspective on biodiversity loss, a desentimentalized view that isn't caught up in the fascination with the last of the species or the beauty and tragedy of impending death that makes the elegiac mode so alluring, but in some ways also so misleading. Now, what that desentimentalist perspective looks like is perhaps nowhere most obvious than when the database aesthetic turns on humans ourselves. So let's go and look up Homo sapiens on the IUCN Red List. Here we go. I don't know how well you can see this. Let me pull this over a little bit, and then I'll scroll down. And I guess this is cutting off my scrolling here. That's not so good. Anyway, so you'll have to take it. Let me see if I can. It's not letting me scroll down. We'll do it later you'll have to take on faith what it says further down on the page. But as you can already see at the top of the page here, the IUCN classifies as a species of least concern that is not endangered. And it says a little down from here, listed as least concern as the species is very widely distributed, adaptable, currently increasing, and there are no major threats resulting in an overall population decline. Under major threats, which is one of the other major entries always, the Red List informs us that, quote, there are currently no major threats to humans, although some subpopulations may be experiencing localized declines as a result of disease, drought, war, natural disasters, and other factors. And under the heading conservation actions, the Red List assures us that, at present, no conservation measures are required. Humans are present in numerous protected areas throughout their range, which includes even the International Space Station. The inclusion of Homo sapiens in a biodiversity database is a significant gesture, I think, politically and philosophically. It may stand as a signal that the major challenge confronting humans in the face of global biodiversity crisis is to reconceive themselves as a species among species, a process begun with Darwin's theory of evolution, but at this point requiring a new translation into the realm of ethics and politics. That new translation, I'd like to suggest, requires a more resolute turn away from environmentalism's roots in European romanticism than we've undertaken so far. And databases, I'd like to propose, could be a useful tool in making that turn. Thank you. Get out of my PowerPoint.
Okay, well, it is now my great pleasure to introduce our respondent, Neil Pishner, who is a PhD candidate in comparative literature at Rutgers University. His dissertation, which is in progress, examines how cultural performances offer unique windows of understanding onto the relatively unmapped terrain of Latin American people's relationships with the physical environment. His transdisciplinary research has a strong ethnographic component and intersects with performance studies, linguistic anthropology, and the environmental humanities within the contemporary indigenous Latin American context, that of Andean Peru. Please welcome Neil Pishner.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Ursula, for that fascinating presentation. Kind of in sync with my introduction, I'm going to offer to complement and join to her presentation some ideas that come from my own research without necessarily referring anything specifically to it, but it's just kind of the mode of frame that I've been in, with the hopes of maybe opening up the discussion on databases and narrative, the narrative of the decline of nature, the loss of species, and the notion of loss itself. And so where to start? The database is very interesting from my perspective in that at first glance it appears to be an epitome of what we might call in performance studies the archive. This cataloging, this enumeration, this listing, without any even apparent narrative to be there at first glance. But once you look a little further into it, you might perceive a narrative such as the loss of species or the decline of nature. Well, then we get into a metaphorical kind of interpretation. We're looking at things metaphorically. And what I find very interesting is then to contrast that with, rather than this archival aspect of biodiversity and biodiversity losses, a repertoire of practices and performances. And so by this, I don't mean to lead the discussion towards that. I just kind of want to explore the space between these and the tensions and see if it produces any other interesting ideas. So I'm talking about doing, practicing, in terms of reflecting and something that reflects and shapes society. And what I found interesting in Ursula's talk is that the database, if I'm understanding correctly, can also do this because the user is involved and can select the parameters that's being used. And so it's not just about a metaphorical narrative. It's the user is actually shaping something here. And but what I find interesting in practice and performance is this aspect of lived experience. And I think that with looking at database and biodiversity loss and thinking about the decline of nature, the loss of nature, we really get this strong emphasis of loss, even with the visual, the art, the graphic art examples that we saw, heavy emphasis on extinction, etc., surrendering, habitat fragmentation, species loss. And what I think is interesting is that this is can lodge this kind of in rhetoric and text, whereas when we talk about lived experience and practices and performances, we're talking about embodied experiences, so in the flesh, in the senses, in dance, in aromas, in tastes, in walking, in evoking place names, in sharing seeds, in sharing a meal, in sharing the names of plants and their uses as well. And so I think it's interesting to kind of insert into our conversation the notion of sensory emotive experience. Let me suggest, let me bring this up, instead of desentimentalizing, can we sentimentalize? The database has this normative and descriptive aspect in its cataloging impulse. In practices and performances, we may find aesthetics, and emotion, and imagination, and cultural memory too. Ursula talked about cultural memory. I think this is a very important point too. That was a notion that's being brought up in this idea of databases and the database impulse and the cataloging impulse, and how it relates to cultural memory. And practices and performances, also with their sensory recall, deal with cultural memory in terms of reflecting it, showing us something about cultural memory, but also actively shaping it. So I guess I'm kind of interested in this difference between archival memory and the memory, cultural memory that is embodied in the senses, in the flesh, in practices and performances. And then to realize myself, and during Ursula's talk, that even for using a database and clicking the different parameters, etc., that I'm also involved in a certain kind of practice. And I guess I find also very interesting the notion of someone sitting behind a computer in a computer lab or at home with a personal computer and being able to use a database and thinking about that as practice, and then comparing that with practices that are done in other kinds of environments and situations, such as I mentioned, dances or evocation of place names or sharing a meal. And I find that maybe there, if we pay attention to these practices and performances, maybe there we're going to see not so much of an emphasis on the narrative of loss of nature or decline of nature. We might find something else going on in these kind of marginal niches that are often fleeting, right? Because they're not part of this kind of archival memory in many cases. They're ephemeral. And so let me just conclude with that, because it seems that eco-criticism is very interested in finding new narratives, and maybe with a lot of emphasis on the narrative of the loss of nature, the decline of nature. Maybe we can open this up not to narrative and just metaphor, but actual doing, lived experience, to the aesthetic side of this, the sensory, emotive side to this, sentimentalizing this. As a famous Zen master, Dogen Zenji, once said, both flowers and weeds have Buddha nature, but humans love flowers and they don't like weeds. So I'll conclude with that.
Well, we have time to take a few questions, so we'll walk around with the mic.
Thanks very much, first of all. I just wanted to offer an alternative reading of the IUCN database or chart that you put out. It's not working out. Would you mind, Ursula, showing the chart of the IUCN?
Sure, let me go back into the... sure, absolutely. Let me actually stop this.
It was an IUCN meeting in the 90s that a marine biologist helped me to understand this very differently. And marine biologists tend to see biodiversity very, very differently from the way this list depicts it. So there are different ways of seeing it, which invoke different narratives, too. There we go, yeah. I mean, it's set up to be in set form, but in fact, the first two green, on the left-hand side, the first two green categories are classes, both belonging to the animal kingdom. And then the third green word there, plants, that's a kingdom. And then others involves three other kingdoms. So in fact, 60% of the kingdoms of known life are actually on the last three lines of that.
Right.
And then there's a whole other kingdom recently discovered.
And microorganisms are not at all represented.
Right. Right.
No bacteria, no prokaryotes, no.
Right. So one reading of this is very public. Also, if you look on the right-hand column, if I'm seeing it correctly, it looks roughly that the level of endangerment, as far as we know it, goes up as you move down, which means that that animals are fairly well off, plants are worse off, and the other three kingdoms, which is most of it, is poorly off. Now that might make you happy if you care about animals, because then you think the animals are better off. But if you care about the last three extinction events, it tended to be the life forms at the bottom of the list which survived. And so there was
But that's wrong, because I mean, 100% you get that out of one species.
Oh, yes, I know, it's a small
N. We don't know. I mean, so, in other words, that 100%, that was precisely my point. It doesn't give you any sense of how endangered or not that huge group of species is.
No.
So I don't think you could just go down and say if they get more endangered as you go down. All you can say is, what you need to look at is how many of these have been assessed.
Right.
And only if a large part of them have been assessed can you draw any conclusion as to how endangered the group is, right?
Right, but then the apocalyptic narrative came from this marine biologist who had this meeting talking about biodiversity, took out a small flask of water about this big, and said, this is seawater, we all look at it, and it looks like water. And he said, there are 7 species in this. They're all endangered, and they are more important than anything you're talking about here, because they're from 7 different phyla and 3 different kingdoms, and they are species which survived the last 1 or 2 great extinction events. And if we have another great extinction event, we're going to need to rely upon these species in these phyla to repopulate. So it was kind of the big apocalypse depends on survival. The big apocalypse depends on what's on the bottom of the chart, not on the top of the chart.
Well, that's, that may have been that guy's, I'm not sure if it was what he actually believed, it may have been what he said in public. There is no consensus about that particular issue. I mean, that question of which species are most crucial for survival is really, really controversial. There are some people who make that argument that, the bacteria, the worms, the stuff that aerates the soil and stuff like that, those are absolutely crucial. But there are also people who make the argument that actually public perception is not so far off, in that often these smaller species are present in multiple variants, and if one of these species goes extinct, actually it often happens that another one takes over that ecological niche. Whereas if you lose top predators, like when the sea otters disappeared from Monterey Bay, it did change the entire ecosystem. Because then sea urchins, the kind of stuff that they fed on, multiplied, which then had catastrophic implications for the algae population. And it was only when they reintroduced the top predators that the ecosystem sort of went back to its previous state. So I think there's as on so many other issues involving biodiversity, for one thing, I've become very cautious about equating what biologists and climate scientists say in public with what they say to each other. There's often a huge discrepancy between the way in which they represent their knowledge in public. It's not that they're lying, but that they represent things very selectively. And when you read what they write, when they write for each other, often sounds quite a bit different and more uncertain. But there's also one of that, what you point out, I think it is a real issue, which is that it's another one of those issues surrounding biodiversity, in which there really isn't any consensus. We don't know, and that's part of the problem, and why conservation efforts are such an exercise in triage, but often triage with criteria that are themselves contested. Which species do we invest our limited funds and our limited manpower and our limited time in to try and save? And there just isn't consensus on that. I fully buy what this guy says, but it may have been one opinion where there's others that say just the opposite, that it would argue even also in marine ecosystems that actually top predators are really, really crucial not to lose. So for what it's worth, from a non-biologist.
Thanks, yeah. Listen, I'm a little bit wondering about ethics. For me, they narrate the birth of a nation. And nations, it's the world, right? But this is precisely, for me, the notion that dissolves when we get ecological awareness. So are databases really epics?
Well, so what I would say is that they're epic in their aspiration, because they really want to reach beyond the teams of scientists that are behind us are, of course, huge international groups with a preponderance of Western scientists, undoubtedly, and a lot of these, I think all of these are mostly Western funded. Jeffrey Bowker, in his First World Funded, I should say, in his book, Memory Practices in the Sciences, has a really interesting map
where he has, with one symbol, he signals where most of the biodiversity database efforts are concentrated and where most of the biodiversity is concentrated. And it's a total case of global north and global south. I mean, the global south has most of the biodiversity, the global north has most of the efforts to catalog that biodiversity. So there is that split. Nevertheless, it needs to be said that these are intensely international efforts, and the effort is to access as much as possible of international archives that exist on particular taxa. That's incomplete, and it's not truly global, I think, is obvious. But I think the attempt is there, and the aspiration is there. Red lists, I think, are different. Those, of course, are often national or subnational. And there are questions also of nationalism often come in, or statism, like in California, why do we invest as much money as we have into rescuing the California condor, and those kinds of things. Is that what you were talking about?
No. The form, the aesthetic form of an epic,
yeah.
Right, the horizon of expectation
right.
is that it's narrating the birth of a nation. I'm not worried about which existing nation gets in, but what nation is being born.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
This,
okay,
is that a good way to think
misunderstood.
Ecology?
Yeah. Well, epics narrate origins of nations. They also sometimes narrate the end of nations, right? And that, or the possibility of apocalyptic endings. And I think it would, this would probably fit more into that. But I think that, I don't think it's a narrative of the birth of a nation in that sense. What it is making available information about the world such as we know it. And as an epic, that was actually material that was reconfigured in very different ways by different singers or speakers. Since epics come out of oral culture originally, that was actually material that in an odd resonance with the user, the freedom that the user with an EPRI database has to reconfigure the data, actually was enabled singers or speakers to re-narrate and also reshape the birth of the nation in very significant ways, right? And if you look at epics outside of, the canonical ones of the West, one of the striking things about them is how much they also change when a different dynasty comes into power and changes the genealogies and changes the narrative, right? But yeah, no, I don't think this is about, I think it is about our place as Homo sapiens in the species world. I'm not sure it's an account of origins. So to the extent that you consider that an indispensable ingredient of epic, right, this is an epic.
Okay, we have time for a couple more questions. So.
Yes.
I'm just wondering if you could maybe speak a bit more about some of the implications that you see of this increasing use of a database form of narrative. I'm thinking about the experience I've had being at the Convention on Biological Diversity, the last COP, and go to the side events that were put on by business people, and they were completely using, obviously, the database form of narrative. And the ones that were put on by the large conservation organizations were also using this, but sort of alternative voices and voices for we don't like the direction that the CBD is going, we have a different vision for what biodiversity is and what conservation should mean. None of those used database form of narrative. They were all individualized stories of communities and communities in community with their local ecosystem, etc. So I'm just wondering, is that one of the results of us shifting into more and more of a database narrative? Does that mean that it's another way of sort of pushing out or othering marginalized voices?
I think the answer is yes and no. So I think there's a couple of things to be said about that. I mean, the interest of theorists like Lesmanovich in the database mode is because it is absolutely pervasive. I mean, forget about biodiversity every time you look something up on Google, right? I mean, every time you use Wikipedia, every time you buy something on the internet, you're interacting with databases. So that's, I think, what prompts the interest of a lot of media theorists and social scientists in the database as sort of this new environment that where before it was a very specialized tool for researchers, business administrators, librarians, and so forth, archivists of various kinds. Neil is absolutely right about that. It's now become sort of a pervasive environment that we interact with and use and all have a certain kind of expertise in using. And by we, I mean people who have internet access, obviously. And I realize that that excludes a lot of people. There's also an increasing number, steadily increasing number around the world. And so that's what the media theorists are interested in, is that this is becoming sort of a thing that we constantly use without, for the most part, even being conscious of this being a database that was designed in particular ways, that has particular methods of searchability, and that excludes others. And now that's why the metadata problem is so urgent, is because precisely in most of these databases there is, for example, no way of recording indigenous knowledge. That's what I meant when I was saying metadata enable, I mean, it's not just a matter of which particular species you plug in and which ones you leave out, but there's also just certain kinds of knowledge that we simply don't have a category for. We don't have any way of translating it into the categories such as they are defined. Now, there's nothing sort of particularly inevitable about that. You could perfectly design other categories. The fact is that most of the time, when these decisions are taken, they tend to exclude certain categories of knowledge. So in that respect, I would agree with you. At another level, though, I'm not quite sure that I buy a total opposition between people who use community-based stories and people who use databases. I think a lot of conservationists around the world use both. They use the database to get a sense of, you know, what are the assessments of certain taxa. If, the green turtle is declining here, is it surviving elsewhere? Could we bring specimens from another part of the world to repopulate our ecosystem? I mean, these things are done on a very routine basis. And I don't think they're necessarily in any contrasting, and that would also be a partial answer to Neil, I don't think they're necessarily in any incompatibility with stories that are more local and that often are local witnessings of larger trends that you then only can see when you actually see the global numbers, right? Does that answer your question at all? So I resist a little bit sort of what I hear implicit in part of your question, which is, oh, this is just a thing that big corporations use. No, I mean, this is a thing that a lot of impassioned conservationists use, and I don't think that using that kind of database per se precludes other kinds of narratives. In fact, I mean, this invites certain other kinds of narratives.
Is it essentially
the
same? I just wondered if we could talk a little bit about the economics of energy in the marketplace of nature, because I think it seems like for the foreseeable future, given the financial muscle of energy, that is likely to be around in perpetuity. And just to give you sort of a grounded example of that, within the limited context of funding for conservation in South Africa, there's one national park called the Adder National Park that wanted to expand from 5 biomes to 7 in the name of biodiversity. But it knew that was not a saleable hook for the tourism people. So instead what they said, everybody comes here for the big 5, the rhino, lion, leopard, buffalo, you can forget what the fifth one is, elephant, yeah. And when you combine the idea of rarity, endangerment, and charismatic megafauna, you've got money. And so they said, what we're gonna do is we're gonna add a maritime biome. And instead of the big 5, we're going to be the only national park in the world that has the big 7, including the great white shark and the southern right whale. Okay. So that was the way that they got support at a national level from the tourist board to expand and in biodiversity terms and protect what they really wanted to do. But they had a sales pitch, which was all about energy and all about science. So I'm wondering about, you know, whether academically we can kind of critique and phase out elegy, but elegy is such a driver in the marketplace.
No, I think you're totally right. And I mean, in this talk today, I sort of foreshortened the part on elegy hugely just because some people had already read the article on it and I didn't want to unnecessarily repeat. I think you're absolutely right that the overwhelming majority of certainly written, printed publications are in one way or another based on that mode, and even some of the photography is. And you could see that in that one shot of Sartorius that I showed, that even in the artists and the writers that have that other impulse, there's often a combination of the two modes in some way. And I agree that that's the main fundraiser right now, and I don't necessarily want to get rid of it. I mean, it's also more than a fundraiser. I mean, I think there is something really important that happens in elegy, which is that reflection on modernization and its modalities, to the point where sometimes, as in the case of the Japanese Honshu Wolf, in the public awareness, the facts of the case are actually misconstrued, where most Japanese today believe that the Honshu Wolf went extinct in the 40s and 50s. It didn't. It died out in 1905. But since the anxieties about modernization of Japanese society are mostly focused on the 40s and 50s and that transformation, that sort of the historical facts actually sort of get adjusted to what the cultural story and the cultural imagination is. So I'm not necessarily saying that we should get rid of elegy, but I nevertheless do think that the critique of this is important, and I think it's important in two ways. Not that I'm saying that we immediately need to stop talking about it that way, but I do think we need to have a conversation about the larger vision of nature that is behind elegy, and that narrative that we're always saying that nature is declining, that it's degrading, that it's deteriorating. And I think there's ways in which it's actually very difficult to make that case scientifically, if that matters to you, which it may not. But there's other ways in which I also think that narrative in some ways has reached the limit of the people it's going to reach. I mean, the people who want to hear that and give money for that are already giving it, and beyond that, people want a sort of more future-oriented narrative, and one that has a vision of what the future of nature might be, other than just it's continuously going down the drain. And so what I'm sort of groping toward here is, you know, are there other ways of thinking about this without denying the facts, you know, without saying, oh, this extinction isn't happening. I mean, I'm not interested in making that argument. These things are happening. But it's also true that if you look over longer time spans, for example, we are at an incredible peak of biodiversity. The Earth has rarely had as much biodiversity as it has now. So we're going to go back to something else that may be catastrophic for us, and, you know, and of course, I think all of us in this room probably, in our solitary moments, you get incredibly depressed because you know that some of the things that you most love in life are going to go away in the next 50 years. You know, there's just no question about it. Is that going to be relevant, though? I mean, you know, tying into the generational question that came up this morning, for the kids that are born tomorrow, are they necessarily going to be that concerned with that? I wonder, because we don't really have a clear perception of what biodiversity was around 200 years ago. So, I mean, there's different ways of thinking about that, about the shifting baselines, and about, you know, what we construe to be the overall narrative of our relationship with the environment. And I think, you know, it might be fine to see if there aren't other templates out there. And I mean, I totally agree that those templates might not immediately capture the same donors, but I think it is worth thinking about. The other thing that's behind this, the other big question, is that the question of what is the relationship, what should the relationship between environmentalist thought and science be? Because I mean, I think we went through a phase where environmentalists in general and eco-critics in particular in very sort of unproblematic ways derive value judgments from what they perceive to be the science, and then environmental historians and some eco-critics and eco-philosophers said, well, look, again, that isn't actually what the science now is. Nature isn't static, and so on and so forth. And then science kind of dropped out of the equation. I mean, nobody really talks about science anymore because we didn't know what to do with it if it doesn't provide us with value judgments. And I think that's a loss. I think we need to find other ways. I mean, without giving science that role again, I mean, I don't think science can tell us what there should be. And these figures don't tell you what you should do.
Yeah, I was literally asking about the
academic, even the scientific discussion about ecology. But if we step right out of the university and right out of the research realm into tourism, what do we have to weigh against ecology as a touristic hook that may help those of us who want to achieve some biodiversity preservation, achieve those ends by perhaps devious means?
So first that
take the mic.
Oh, sorry. Where is it?
It's right
here. Oh, sorry. Sorry about that. I'm not sure, but I see sort of some possibilities, and the book that I made, The Cost Free, precisely sort of to think about that question is Douglas Adams and Mark Carradine's Last Chance to See, which is a slight book. It came out of a BBC radio series that they did on their trips around the world to see the last of the species, but which sounds at first as if it's completely predicated precisely on that ecotourism spectacle economics, as well as on the romantic fascination with the last of the species. But then they really turn it upside down through pervasive irony, but also something beyond that. I don't want to make this out to be a masterpiece or anything. It's not, and it doesn't want to be. But what Douglas Adams does is actually something that I find very interesting, which is that he turns upside down the usual narratives the usual sort of conceptual maneuvers that ecology is based on, which is, oh, here are these wonderful, perfectly adapted organisms that have evolved over millions of years and are now in perfect sync with their environment, and we're destroying that. But what he emphasizes in his descriptions of both nature and culture is how spectacularly maladapted a lot of animals are, and a lot of people, including himself. So he talks about the mating, that's my favorite part of the book, the mating habits of the New Zealand kakapo, a flightless parrot. And he describes how the male parrots sort of excavate these holes in the ground so that they have more resonant mating calls. And so he says, so they call and call, and the bowl has the effect of a subwoofer. It amplifies the sound, but whoever hears it can't localize the direction it's coming from. And he says, well, that's a bit of a shortcoming in a mating call, right? Because the females just kind of walk around, and they hear the mating calls, and they can't find the males. And they walk for miles and miles, and it doesn't happen. And the males, in the meantime, keep calling and calling. Moreover, the females, in order to even get into the mood of walking around looking for males, have to eat that particular fruit from a particular tree that only blooms every 2 years. So everybody gets extremely worked up and frustrated, waiting for trees to bloom and waiting for females to arrive. And then when finally they get together, the female lays a single egg like that, then immediately gets eaten by a predator. And he says, well, you know, given those circumstances, the question is not why is the kakapo in danger. The question is, how has it made it so long, right? And so that's sort of his take on almost everything he sees around him. And it sort of turns that adaptationist logic that everything we see is perfectly adapted upside down, and evolution becomes this series of improbable and wonderful contingencies that it's worth preserving because it could never be redone. So there is that sense of loss. But not because this was, you know, a wonderfully adapted thing that it's tragic to lose, just because it's so erratic and so irrational that it's hilarious and we don't want to lose that. So there is, I think, besides the sense of humor, which I think is really compelling in a lot of ways, but there is also just a different way of thinking about how nature and how we have gotten where we are. And from that follows a somewhat different envisioning of extinction. So I see sort of possibilities there that might actually be really attractive, in which you emphasize the bizarre and the sense of wonder, maybe a little bit taking a page from him, the really strange others, rather than the tragically endangered others.
Perhaps the kakapo are enjoying the music and the snacking, and it has nothing to do with the egg.
Possibly. I mean, there is that too, that of course, and especially as far as birds are concerned, we are, in this particular case, it is the best thing to be mating call, but you're absolutely right. I mean, there is, of course, especially in ornithology, I mean, there are a lot of attempts now, especially as far as bird song is concerned, to detach from that adaptationist logic, and because it just doesn't explain why some birds seem to be able to do their reproductive business perfectly fine on the basis of 3 or 4 or half a dozen calls, and then you have other species, you know, from nightingales to starlings and so forth, that have dozens, if not hundreds, of different calls and invitations that really can't be explained on that adaptationism. So I think Adams, I don't think he was, he knew about, I mean, this book was too early for that research, but I think it's a similar attempt to rethink evolution away from just pure adaptation in terms of reproduction. You're totally right about that.
Were you raising your hand before?
Way before.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to interrupt. It's been a long day, but we are not ready to go yet. And probably precisely because of all the effort that we have put today and the diversity of approaches and presentations that we had today, I think we should devote some minutes for reflecting on the day before leaving. So I'm going to ask Kate, Tim, Ursula, and Rob to come down and sit here on the front and see if we can have a round table, even if not that long, and help us out with